I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. On this Election Day edition of Midday, we are politics free. My guest is the author James Patterson. He's written more than 200 books, and he holds the Guinness World Record for the most number one titles on the New York Times bestseller list. If you're a grown-up fan of the Alex Cross or Michael Bennett series, or a kid who loves the Max Einstein books, you are not alone. More than 380 million copies of James Patterson's books have been sold around the world, and many of his stories have been made into hit movies. James Patterson is also the creator of Kid Stew, a program for young children that begins its new season on PBS next spring. James Patterson joins me here in Studio A when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us on this rainy election day. My guest for the hour is James Patterson, the phenomenally prolific American author who has over the past four decades written more than 200 books for adults, young adults, and children. One of his latest thrillers is a bestseller published last summer that he co-wrote with former President Bill Clinton. It's called The President Is Missing. Mr. Patterson has had more number one books on the New York Times bestseller list than any other author. He has sold more than 380 million books. His novels account for about 6% of all novels sold in the United States, with sales that outpace books by Stephen King, Dan Brown, and John Grisham combined. And for years, he was the most borrowed author in British libraries. James Patterson is also a literary activist who promotes reading by people of all ages, and he's a philanthropist who has backed his activism with millions of dollars in grants and scholarships to support reading programs in schools and universities and libraries across the country. A few years back, he launched an online platform to promote reading by young people called Read Kiddo Read, and a public television series he created to encourage kids to read and explore creative outlets will begin its second season this spring. It's called Kid Stew. If you'd like to join our conversation with James Patterson, we will take your calls and comments a little bit later in the program. We are streaming our conversation on Facebook Live. You can also send us an email to midday@wipr.org or a tweet at @midday_wipr. Jim Patterson, nice to meet you.
Hi.
Welcome.
Nice to be here.
So let's start with talking about this TV series, Kid Stew.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me that you chose television as the medium for kids, because there's a certain school of thought that says TV is kind of on its way out. You know, everything is screens that are portable. And
well, we'll get to that. We'll go online and we'll get onto screens. But, you know, there still are a lot of kids that watch television, a lot of people that watch television more than listen to radio. And here we are on radio.
Yeah, here we are. Exactly.
So, I mean, there really are a lot of people. And unfortunately, television has sort of forsaken kids. There used to be, when I was growing up, there'd be a lot of Saturday morning stuff. PBS, I think, was doing a much better job than they are now in terms of kids, especially kids from like 7 to 12 or 13. And the whole spirit of Kid Stew, which is actually in Maryland, this weekend on Saturday, they're going to...
there's a marathon.
Yeah, there's a marathon, which is very cool. So from like 6:30 to
8:30,
yeah.
So you'll be able to see all of the episodes of season one.
Four of them, yeah, right. And what it's about, what Kids Do is about the joy of learning, and in a lot of ways, it's a principle that you'd like to see in more schools, where you're raising their curiosity, you're getting them involved, and it's just a joyful experience. And I would say, Kids Do is sort of like a combination of the Discovery Channel and Saturday Night Live, but toned down Saturday Night Live. It's very funny at times, but you're learning so much, and it's very fast paced. And it's just been a joy to do it.
Did you take it upon yourself? I mean, you've written for children,
yeah.
You've written for young adults, you've mm-hmm. obviously written lots of thrillers for adults.
Yeah.
But did you make it a study to say, what kind of a program would be good? I mean, your target age is evidently 7 to 12.
Well, so I think it's kind of 5 to 12. Mm-hmm. We underestimate. Little kids, And God knows they take them to the movies when they're five. And the thing that people need to understand about younger kids is they're used to not understanding everything. When they go through life,
and they're fine with that.
And they're okay. That's the deal. I walk into the room. I know what I know. And they're cool with it. And in this case, they're watching other kids. The whole show is nothing but kids.
So right. All of the hosts are kids.
All of the, and when like two kids, like there's a regular segment where they'll go back in time. They go into a phone booth, which is kind of funny as a, the way to, because the phone
Speaking
booth
of
is
an
back
anachronism,
in time.
Right, yeah. Right.
And, you know, they will go back and meet Leonardo da Vinci or whatever. But it's Leonardo played by a kid or Einstein played by a kid. And even little kids will laugh at that. You know, they may not totally get it, but they get enough of it, and they love to watch older kids. So it's, you know, and I just think it's a good thing to do. It's, I mean, that's kind of what I try to do with whether it's, you know, classroom libraries, which we're supporting around the country now, or in this case, Kids Do.
Because you mentioned how fast-paced it is. Mm-hmm. That's interesting to me because I remember when Sesame Street was in its heyday, and that was, of course, on PBS. It's no longer. Now it's a premium cable. It's on HBO.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the kid, there were two women, I think, in Dallas who created Barney. Remember that series,
sure,
Barney?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And their whole approach was
hypnotize the kids.
Yeah, maybe the purple dinosaur. But right. Their whole perspective was Sesame Street was too busy. Mm. There was too much stuff going on. The screen popped with all this stuff happening second by second. So they have a purple dinosaur, three other kids who hang out with him. They sing songs that are
I just wish people would stop doing this world of either or as opposed to either and. They're both valid. Mr. Rogers couldn't have been more calm, couldn't have been slower and wonderful.
Yeah.
Kids Do, very, very energetic and wonderful.
Let's listen to a little.
I think we just need, I wish, just in general, I mean, we're in an election time now. I wish we could do more of, it's not black and white. It's complicated.
Yeah.
And a lot of things can work, especially with children.
Indeed. Let's listen to a little clip. This is a clip from the first season of Kids Do. There are nine cast members. They're all preteens. These are Caroline and Luke in this one, and they're comparing the books that they're reading. So Caroline has this big, thick, hefty book, and Luke has a slim little volume. Here's what they say.
Hey, Caroline, what are you up to?
Let's see, I'm up to chapter 15. I'm almost done with the book.
Well, that thing is a total doorstop. It would take me a year to read that. I'd actually probably give up.
Give up? You're kidding, right? And miss all the juicy parts? No way.
I always try and find the shortest book I can find. It's, don't judge.
Hey, I like short books too, but reading long books isn't any different. All you gotta do is break it down.
Give me a beat. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Turn up my headphones, man. All right. If a book looks thick, don't whip out. You can take it, you can make it, cause there's no doubt. Just read it, take your time, the time will fly. Just divvy it up.
There we have, you know, teaching kids to not be afraid of big books.
Yeah.
And that was the wonderful thing about Harry Potter. Very, very big books. And kids got into reading big books. And that's terrific. You know, J.K. Rowling, she saved thousands of lives around the world. Because if kids get to the point where
think
they're
that's
competent
fair.
Readers, there's a chance they can get through high school if you're competent readers. If you're not a competent reader, boy, is it hard. To move on with your education.
And that, you know, igniting that flame, getting that love of learning, that lifelong love mm-hmm. of learning is something that teachers in classrooms try to do every day. What are the things you can do on this television program that maybe teachers don't have the capacity to pull off in a day-to-day classroom
situation? Well, it's easier. I mean, it's a half an hour thing. So, we don't have to do it day in and day out. We don't have to deal with kids that don't necessarily want to learn, or they're, you know, you have some troublesome kids in a class, or some kids that want to lay down and fall asleep. So we don't have any of those problems, the problem of just doing the same thing day after day. So it's easier for us. But the principle of combining a certain amount of fun, being aware that you know, concentration spans aren't what they used to be. You know, when I was with President Clinton, he would talk about, you know, the the concentration span of a butterfly is like 9 seconds, and humans are 8 now.
Yeah, you know, it's less. Like,
okay.
Right.
So,
and do you think that's different? Is that true for children as well?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, this is
so. Children in 2018 have a shorter attention span than I had in the 1960s when I was a little kid.
I would say that's correct. Yes. Yeah. At any rate, I mean, it is what it is. Not that I want it to be that way, but that is the way it is. And as I said, the key here is, I mean, they learn a lot, you know, in each episode, but it's served up with some fun. And so they stay with it. I just did a book on Einstein, but I'll get into how that relates, you know, maybe later in the show.
Yeah.
So stay tuned, because the Einstein thing is really cool.
That's right. We're going to hear really cool stuff about Einstein, Max Einstein. And that's it's a series you have for children. Well, actually, while we're at it, tell us a little bit about that. I mean, because you do a number of series for children and adults.
It's relevant to kids, too, because it's the same principle. The Einstein Institute and the Einstein Estate, they came to Disney Scholastic, and I have a little imprint at Little Brown, and they said, what we want to do is around the world get young kids interested in Einstein and his scientific theories.
We should be clear, these are the keepers of the flame of Einstein.
These are the
keepers
of the flame.
This is the Einstein Institute itself.
Which is in Jerusalem. And they're very smart, as you would expect, people that associate with Einstein. And they said, it has to be entertaining. Otherwise, kids won't stay with it. And so the job is I have to make Einstein and his theories entertaining. And they said, yep, that's it. And all they gave us was the name Max Einstein. And I said, okay, well, when I went back to them and we ultimately, they said, you're our guys, you do it. And I said, I'd like to make Max a girl, because not everywhere, but in a lot of places, it's still, you know, women and girls are not seen as, you know, that they can have careers in science and math. And some places it's totally accepted and whatever. But even if you go to these tech companies, a lot of them, and you go, and there's still, it's like 90% male. And so
oh,
I said,
sure.
I think
the Me Too movement in Silicon Valley has been well
so
documented.
So I think it's still, I think it's a good thing. And they agreed. They said, you know, that this is terrific, that Max. And then the thing is, how do you make it entertaining? How do you combine science and things that kids are going to love? So, like the first chapter, literally just the first chapter, we meet Max, and she's homeless, and she lives in New York City, and she's very bright. She knows everything about Einstein, and we find out a little later she's actually attending NYU, even though she's 11, 12 years old. And she's in this building with a lot of other homeless people, and the bottom two floors are have horses that go out and ride in Central Park, and they're heated. The top four floors are homeless people, and it's not heated. And she goes to the person that's sort of the prime mover among the homeless people, and she says, listen, I know how to heat the top four floors, but I need the manure from the horses, and I'm going to turn it into methane gas, and I'm going to heat. You know, so we're telling the story. We're introducing us to Max. We're showing that she's a very bright young person, and we're starting to get into science.
That's terrific. And these are all really conscious decisions, too, that, you know, non-writers among us need to understand that, you know, this stuff takes some figuring out before you launch into it.
Well,
I love the fact that she's a she, mm-hmm. and secondly, that she's homeless and that she's a genius, and all of those things are mm-hmm. concurrent.
Yeah. And then kids, too. I mean, how do you talk about art and history and geography and inventions and science and whatever? You know, there's a giant brain in Kids Too, who will talk about the function of the brains every episode. And how do you do it in a way so that kids are going to stick with it, as opposed to, Mom, you want to turn the channel off, or I want to go out? Or unfortunately, they don't go out. They just go to their little screen and watch something that isn't necessarily. But even if you start looking around and a lot of the stations now, I mean, even the Disney Channel, it's all a lot of soap operas. And that's, I mean, I don't know. I think we can do better.
And the technique of teaching, I mean, pedagogy as an art has also advanced considerably. I mean, there's been a lot of data collected over the decades about how kids learn, how certain kids learn differently from other kids.
Yeah.
And so that you can use all of that data to create a show.
Yeah, I mean,
or create
people
a book
don't think
anything.
About the brain and how we all, well, everybody, if there isn't, like, for example, if I close my eyes, I cannot picture my house. I cannot picture my wife's face. I mean, literally, I get vague sense. A lot of people, they just can't imagine, because they can. They can close their eyes and they can, oh, yeah, there's my children, there's my house, there's my, I don't. The point being that a lot of us, we just, the way our brains work is just different. One, you know, from person to person to person.
And it's not a matter of your not having an imagination. I mean, 209 books later, I think that's a pretty easy
case to make. That may have actually helped me to have more of an imagination. You know, the fact that I couldn't and I had to invent so much. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think growing up, I grew up in upstate New York, and when I, there weren't a lot of kids around, and I would just wander in the woods and make up stories all the time. And I remember I went to graduate school at Vanderbilt, and I used to have to drive down from Massachusetts. And when I was driving, I would write musicals in the car. I would just, for the whole, and just write a musical and sing the songs.
The tunes
and, do
and
the
everything.
Lyrics,
yeah.
And the whole
do the book,
thing.
The lyrics, and the music.
Yeah, and there it was. Yeah. And then I would, for better or worse, probably for better, I never wrote this stuff down. And that was the end. One performance only.
One performance. Yeah. Hey, rare event. A musical in the car. My guest today is the best-selling author James Patterson. He's also the creator of the PBS television show Kid Stew. Maryland Public Television will air a Kid Stew marathon of 4 episodes from the first season Saturday morning. This coming Saturday, 6:30 to 8:30. And the new season launches next May. We'll have more with James Patterson right after a quick break. You are welcome to join our conversation. 410-662-8780. Our email midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet @MiddayWYPR. If you want to follow me on Twitter @TomHallWYPR, and we are streaming our conversation with James Patterson on Facebook Live. Stick around, we will be right back.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR, where you're listening to Midday.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Today, of course, is Election Day. We'll have complete coverage of all the national and local election news tonight, starting at 8 o'clock here on WYPR. The WYPR news team will be fanned out across the state covering the post-election parties for various campaigns, and I'll be here in Studio A. I'll speak to a lot of expert analysts who have covered all of the big Maryland campaigns, plus NPR. We'll have all the latest results from around the country. Our coverage begins at 8 o'clock tonight here on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And tomorrow here on Midday, we'll parse the results of the election with veteran political observers Jane Miller of WBAL Television and Andy Green, the editor of the editorial page of the Baltimore Sun. If you've just joined us today, my guest is the best-selling author and philanthropist James Patterson. He's written more than 200 books, including one he released last summer with former President Bill Clinton. It's called The President Is Missing. James Patterson is also the creator of a kids television series on PBS called Kid Stew, which will begin its second season next spring. You are welcome to join our conversation with James Patterson at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. To follow me on Twitter, @TomHallWYPR. And you can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Jim Patterson, speaking of Facebook, you have released a book on Facebook Messenger. How's that
I
work?
Well, you know, we started off with Kid Stew, and I love to do things that are different. And, you know, with Kid Stew, it's the notion of combining educating kids with a lot of fun. In the case of Facebook, what we're doing there, it's on Facebook Messenger, and I'm actually releasing a new novel. It's free, so you can go on Facebook Messenger and get it for free. But what's really different about it, one, that it's on Facebook and it, you know, they've never done a novel before. But secondly, you'll be reading and then it goes to film. So we shot film that tells the story. So it's I don't think anybody's experienced.
So it's a combination.
It's a combination of, and then you read some more, and it might go to stills, and then you read some more, and then it'll be all newspaper headlines about the, you know, the case that's being dealt with. It's called The Chef, and it's about a well, I write a lot about detectives. This fellow, at least in the beginning of the story, is a detective in New Orleans, but he also has a food truck called Killer Chef, which he runs with his ex-wife, which is an interesting thing in itself. But what really is fun about it is you're reading and then there's film of the thing, and then you're reading and there's some more film, and then you're reading and there's stills, and then there's audio tracks where you hear the characters, and you know. So it's not like anything else. And I love that. I love doing something that either nobody's done or hasn't been done very often.
Yeah, that's certainly outside my experience. I've never heard of that. I mean, that going back and forth and juxtaposing print versus video or stills. How do you, as you're writing this, as you're creating this and you're thinking this through, or you're thinking, you know, how the arc of the story is going to go, how do you decide what part is going to be video, what part is going to be literary?
Well, I wrote the book first, so I knew the story. And then it really was an issue of, okay, how does film, how can it heighten that experience? And then we will go out and shoot. You know, for example, one of the things that isn't in the book is an interview that happens after the story with the main character, and he's being interviewed by the FBI, and it sort of suggests like maybe he's a guilty party here. So it's building even more suspense that wasn't in the novel originally. And it's also visual because here he is talking to you, which is just a cool thing to, you know,
James Patterson is my guest. He is an award-winning he had multiple successes.
Multi-head.
He's a multi-headed monster.
Multi-fingered.
He's multi-fingered, and he's sitting here in Studio A. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet, @midday WYPR, and you can catch us on Facebook if you're not reading Mr. Patterson's latest book, on Facebook Messenger, because we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. So is this, for example, this new one, The Chef book, is this a young adult? Is this an old
adult? It's an
adult
book.
Okay. So when you are writing for, because you write for little kids, I mean, first-time early readers, you write for the sort of so-called middle-aged group, young adult fiction, which is a huge sector of the market now. And you also wrote
the young adult thing is interesting. It's huge when there's a huge book out. So when Hunger Games was out, it was huge. And partly, I mean, what they've figured out that happens with YA is if it crosses over into where adults are reading it too, it becomes huge.
Like Harry Potter.
As many
grown-ups read that as their children.
Right.
Yeah. Do you sit down to begin one of these books for one of these different age groups in a totally different head? I mean, how do you make the demarcation
the so-called rules of real estate, you know, location. For what I do, my only rule is story. I want to tell a story. I pretend there's somebody sitting across from me. I don't want them to get up until I'm done telling the story.
You want to keep them mesmerized.
Yeah, and it has to be something where I go, like, I can't wait to tell that story, and I think people are going to enjoy it. I have a sense of, you know, where it's going to go. I have a sense of what the twists and the turns. I have the sense of you know, like I said, the idea of a guy running a food truck, a detective running a food truck, and being really interested in food. And one of the reasons that Facebook wanted to do it with film is we also have a lot of food in it, visualized. So it'll make you hungry.
Too bad you can't do it in Odorama.
Right. Well, that can, you know.
That's next.
Hold on for a couple of years. We'll be able to do that. But that, you know, and it gets me excited to do it. So then I'm, you know, and the same with the kids' books that I do. If I'm excited to write it and I think people are going to like the story, then off I go.
I just read the book you read with you wrote with Mr. Clinton, President Clinton, called "The President Is Missing." Mm. Is there an ideal reader for you? Is there a way you want anybody to of whatever age to approach the work that you do?
No, I mean, it's you know, it's all over it a lot. I mean, I actually with my wife, we do Big Words for Little Geniuses for real little kids, to, you know, people that are 100 years old. I mean, it's, and I don't, it's, I think it's the people who like my books, I think, who just like a good story. I'm not a great stylist. I write the way we tell stories to one another. I could tell you a really cool story. And, you know, my father grew up in the Newburgh Poorhouse in Newburgh, New York. His mother was a charwoman there, which meant that she cleaned the bathrooms and the kitchen, whatever, and they got a room, which they shared, and that's the way he grew up. He was a bright guy. He was going off to World War II, and he got a call from this guy who lived about 25 miles away. And the guy said, "My name is George Hazleton, and I'm about to go off to the Pacific Theater." And he said, "After dinner tonight or last night, my parents took me down to the living room and they said, 'George, you know, we love you so very, very much, but you're going to go off to the war. And we have to tell you that you're not our natural son. We adopted you.'" And then this George Hazleton said to my father, he said, "I'm your brother." They both came back from the war, you know, in one piece, and they became great friends. But 3 or 4 years later, after they came back, my uncle called up and he said, "I found our father, who had run away from, you know, the family early on, and he's tending bar in Poughkeepsie." And my uncle said, "I'm going up to see him tonight." You know, neither one had ever seen him. My father said, "I don't want to see him." So my uncle went up by himself to this it was a little bar under the bridge, the Poughkeepsie Bridge, and it was a couple, you know, of rummies in the bar, and it was smelled of stale beer and whatever. And my uncle isn't a drinker, so he had like a Coca-Cola. And here's his father, who he's never seen before, never met. He's so turned off by this guy as a human being that he leaves without ever telling the guy that he's his son. Mm. All right, so there's a cool story. There isn't a great...
Is any of it true?
That's totally true. Mm-hmm. All of it's true, mm-hmm. Yeah. And
does that matter?
But the probably not. Okay. But there isn't a great sentence in the story. That's colloquial storytelling. Now, if everybody wrote that way, if Gabriel Garcia Marquez wrote that way, it'd be a disaster. Or if James Joyce wrote that way, it'd be disappointing, et cetera. But that's the way I write, and it's a valid approach. It's an approach.
You were, for a little while, in the advertising business.
Yeah, but I've been clean for over 20 years.
Yeah, more than 20 years. You wrote your first book in 1976 while working at J. Walter Thompson, and you weren't just in the advertising business. You became the head of the whole operation in North America. I mean, you were a big
cheese. J. Walter Thompson.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So is advertising a lot about storytelling, too, or is that just something that you were?
I think most things are about storytelling.
Biding your time.
Look, here's your, you know... NPR, and there's a story. And the story is, it's going to be intelligent, it's going to be thoughtful, it's going to be, you know, whatever. And that's the story. And I think it's, by and large, a true story. And it sustains, you know, this network across the country. Everything, Baltimore has a story. And we're in Baltimore right now. And the story in the last several years hasn't been a great story. Due to a lot of, you know, violent episodes that have, but it's not really the story of Baltimore. It's a story that gets told a lot because, you know, violence tends to take over the headlines, and sometimes you just want to change the story. When I go out, I do usually once a year. I'll do a graduation speech at college, and it's always a different speech, but it's always about the power of stories. So here we are at the University of Texas, and I'll talk about what the story at the University of Texas is and then tell a lot of other stories that I think have some significance to families who are, you know, where they've just brought a kid through college and the kids who are going off to do other things.
There are those who contend that there are really, when it all gets boiled down
seven
to basic,
stories.
There are seven stories. Yeah. You know, some have even said three or something like that. You know, Romeo and Juliet is the love story that everybody's been rewriting.
There seem to be a lot of cool variations on the seven, if that's true. I don't know if it's true or not, but yeah.
And the verisimilitude of the story, I mean, is that an important thing? Is the sort of complete, like in this thriller that you've written?
It's interesting that you would have said, "Is that true?" I mean, that's a curious response.
I mean, I assumed it was. Yeah, I just assumed it was, but
does it matter? I think it matters. in right now, and I think it's particularly relevant. You would hope, and I'm not. I don't like to get into. I don't like it when celebrities and many celebrities get up and because they have a soapbox. So I'm not going to get political. But I think it is useful that we believe our politicians are within reason telling the truth. I think that's a real. I think it's a terrible signal to youth that they're, you know, the people that they're supposed to look up to are lying. I think that's awful. So I think it does matter in that sense. In terms of you know, I think also if a book comes out and it's supposed to be nonfiction and it's really made up, James Frey, I know, had a problem with that somewhere along the way. I think that's bad, too.
How about fiction? I mean, because this book, which is a real, as they say, page-turner. I mean,
The president is missing.
They call it a thriller for a reason. Mm-hmm. I mean, you just never quite know what's going to happen when you turn the page. But is the sort of were you aspiring to complete 100% plausibility in every single thing that happens in the book?
President Clinton, what we tried to do is to write a beach read that also had some important things to say. And the beach read, that part is you just keep turning and turning the pages. But anything that's in there, you know, could all of these things happen? Probably not. But if they happened, this is how it could happen. You know, if there was a traitor in the White House, this is how it could happen. If there was an attack on the presidential cavalcade, yeah, this is how it would happen. The important pieces for he and I were, one, to remind people how important and taxing and difficult the job of the presidency is, and to really take it seriously. So be very careful. And once again, I'm not being political, but be very careful who you put in there, because this is a monstrously important and difficult job, especially when something terrible is happening. So given the variety of
potential problems.
Now, the other piece that's very serious here is in terms of the threat that takes place in the book in terms of cyber terrorism. And what happens in this book is totally accurate in terms of that could happen. And we had the advantage of being able to go out to the best experts in the country in terms of, one, could this all happen? And then they vetted everything ultimately and said, yes, all of this could happen. And that's what makes the book extremely scary.
How did you divide the labor in this book when you co-write a book with someone like President Clinton?
Are you too slow? We alternate words. No, I never get into that completely, other than that we both did.
So it's not like he was consulting and you wrote the story. He did some writing.
He was very involved. Yeah. I mean, near the end of the book or at the end of the book, there's a speech, and he wrote all of the speech.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, we promised our listeners that we were going to be politics free today on election day as folks are going out and casting their ballots. Yeah. But there is in the epilogue to this book a peroration about the need to get together.
That's the only place. And you know what, though? Honestly, and I know some people said, oh, you shouldn't do that. What is wrong with saying we all need to get together? Whether you're Democrat or Republican or independent, what is wrong with that? I'm sorry. And it used to be, you know, I remember, you know, talking.
Oh, really? People criticize you for sort of being, quote unquote, political?
And the president would talk about, you know, when he was president, if need be, he would get together with, you know, like with Bossie and say, we got to do something. And they would go do it. And he said, you know, we talked about Obama and Boehner. And he said, they're both decent human beings. And he said, when there was something difficult, they would have gotten together and tried to come to some kind of a solution. He said the political parties wouldn't let them. That's crazy. That's why, I mean, so many people are so upset about the government right now, because they can't come together, or very seldom, not enough certainly, to solve problems.
Yeah, I mean, we have people choosing political stances that are purposely divisive.
For me, it's not political to say that somehow we need to come together and get stuff done and agree. Look, you say this, I say that. Okay, if nobody does anything, then nothing happens. Now, obviously, a lot of people don't want anything to happen at the federal level, so they're very happy that it all gets shut down. So I guess in that sense, I'm being political, because I want things to happen that move. You know, education. I want I want movement. I want things to get better. I want kids to get educated. I want us to have a better reading program, a better approach to reading. I'll get into that a little later, too, with something really exciting we're doing in Florida.
All right, we'll do that when we come back. We'll also take Barry's phone call from Pikesville when we come back from a break with James Patterson. He is a best-selling author, and you can pose your question or your comment at 410-662-8780. You can send an email to midday@wypr.org. You can send a tweet to @MiddayWYPR, and you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. It's Election Day here in Maryland and around the country. Polls are open until 8 o'clock tonight. If you are in line at a polling place tonight at 8, you will be allowed to cast your ballot. And I hope you'll join me and the WYPR news team, as well as a gaggle of political observers, for results and analysis of local and statewide races tonight here on WYPR. And NPR will have all the latest news from around the country as well. Our coverage begins this evening at 8 o'clock. If you've just joined us today here on Midday, we are in a politics-free zone for the hour. My guest is one of the most successful authors in the history of literature. James Patterson holds the Guinness World Record for the most number one New York Times best-selling books. He has sold hundreds of millions of books, and he writes for everyone from very young children to the legions of adults who are fans of his thrillers. His TV show for young children, Kids Stew, will enter its second season next spring. Our phone number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to send us a tweet @MiddayWYPR, and you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. Jim Patterson, let's go to the phones. Barry in Pikesville, thanks for your patience, and welcome to Midday.
Thank you.
And thanks for calling, because I get to wear earphones, and I love this. It's so much cooler with the earphones on.
Yeah, I'm just curious. Just how does he write his books? Because he's always writing with another author, and they come out so often. He's got more than one book going at a time, and how does he keep the parts separated? And how much writing do each of the authors do? Does he write every other chapter, or?
Yeah, it really depends.
The
yeah.
Person does.
I have a big imagination, and I have a file on my desk that just says ideas, and I have literally thousands of ideas for books. And I couldn't do them all, or I couldn't even come close to what I do by myself. And it's not really that unusual to work with other writers. You watch television shows, and usually
there are
writers'
eight, rooms.
Nine, ten.
That
yeah,
make
writers'
those.
Room with ten yeah. writers, and they're doing these 50-page scripts. So it isn't as unusual as you might think. Stephen King has written books with other authors. And I do some by myself, Alice Cross books and some of the others. And then what I will do in every single book is I will write an outline. The outlines range from 50 to 70 pages, and it sort of lays out the story. I then will ask if I'm co-writing a book, I ask the co-writer to come in and contribute because I want their ideas, A, and B, I want them emotionally invested in the story. So if they've contributed, suddenly they're much more interested in writing it than they were before. And then we just move forward. And unlike a publisher who will say, bring us the book in a year or 2 years or whatever it is, I want to look at stuff every couple of weeks and I'll go, hold it, or, you know, hooray, that's wonderful, keep going, or hold it. We've taken a left turn and, you know, we're losing it and I can't even remember who the character is anymore, or et cetera. So it kind of works like that.
I mean, your publicist gave me a list of seven titles that have been released in the last 6 months.
Yeah.
Now, is that purposeful? I mean, is there a particular advantage for having that many titles in the market?
Now, probably not.
I mean, Max Einstein is one of them, and, you know, yeah. And then you've got an Alex Cross book coming out in a couple of weeks. I mean, are you running the business in any particular way? I mean, timing
no,
the release?
No, it's not a business thing, and it's probably, business-wise, it's probably not ideal. I think the publisher would like me to slow down a little bit, but I love it, and I am in a position where I can, you know, and I just have that many stories, and I... You know, look, I hear Steven Spielberg, and probably if it wasn't so complicated to do a film and go out there and add, you know what I mean, which is kind of takes a year to do it and a lot of preparation, he'd probably want to do more stories. And I think that's why some artists like Spielberg will executive produce a lot of stories, because they want to tell more stories. They want to be involved in more stories. My situation is I can be involved in a lot of stories, and I love it. I don't work for a living. I play for a living.
Do you write on a schedule? I talk to a lot of
I
authors.
Write every day.
So, but it's like,
7 days a week.
So 8 to 11, you're writing or something like that?
5:30 in the morning till I don't know when. Mm-hmm. And I'm never bored. And one of the
doesn't
nice
sound
things
like that, the muse is an issue with you, right?
Well, one of the things about writing, you know, being involved with several projects at the same time, you never get writer's block. Writer's block basically comes, I don't know what to do with this story. If I'm stalled, I go to something else and I come back.
So there's no template or anything. There's no sort of modus operandi form that you return to help you block things out, like when you talk about the outline and stuff like that. Do you have the sort of muscle memory because you've written so many books?
I think
so
that's part of it, but I try to do different things. I mean, I started writing kids' books 6 or 7, 8 years ago, whatever it was, and that was a little different. But ultimately, you're still telling stories. And my thing with kids' books is don't condescend to kids. They're just as smart as we are, or smarter. They just don't have quite as much information as we do.
What do you think of the rise in graphic novels, comic books, a lot more kids reading that style as opposed to
prose? There aren't more that are reading it, but I think anything that gets kids reading is just fine. So whether I grew up in comic books, and that's, you know, that's kind of how I learned to read. Different kinds of comic books, you know, Donald Duck and all that. And anything that gets them to become competent or very good readers, I think is fine. And then they'll go from there. Look, if they taught movies in school, it'd be fine. They would learn how to tell a story, how to create characters. But if they started teaching Ingmar Bergman movies, we'd all go, oh, I don't really like movies so much. So it's good that, you know, we get involved in movies because we see a lot of movies that we enjoyed. And I think the same thing is true in books. The more positive our experiences are, the more we're going to want to read more books.
You started an online platform called Read Kiddo Read. Mm-hmm. And as I understand it, this grew out of a concern you had that your own son wasn't reading all that much. I mean, and this is a concern that a lot of parents have.
Sure.
My kid doesn't like books. What do I do?
I've had thousands of people come up to me and say, thank you for getting my kid reading, which is huge. And many, 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 many times they have tears in their eyes because it's such an incredible concern. And if your child isn't reading, or your children aren't reading, it's depressing. It's nerve-wracking. And if you're not, if they aren't reading and you're not a little depressed, you probably should be. I mean, one of the things with parents and grandparents, you have to take responsibility for your kids. And the same, you have rules in the house, don't track mud on the rug, and you have to eat dinner with the family or whatever the rules are in most houses anyway. And same thing with reading. They have to read. I mean, with Jack, our son, he wasn't a big reader, but when he was, I think, 8 years old that summer, we said, Jack, you're going to read every day. And he said, do I have to? And we said, yeah, unless you want to live in a garage. But we went out and we got him about a dozen books, some in the library, some in the local bookstore. And they ranged from Percy Jackson to Wrinkle in Time. And by the end of the summer, he'd read all 12 books. And, you know, when he took his SSATs, he got an 800 in reading. So there you go. I mean, that's one story. Even more important,
10 years later, of course.
Are at risk. Right. Well, SSATs are actually at the end of eighth grade. SATs are later.
Oh, okay.
The kids who are at risk, it's even more important, because if they don't, it's not a question of getting a high SATs, it's a question of becoming a competent reader so that they can go on and finish high school.
Well, Tiffany writes on Facebook that you're one of my son's favorite authors. He is age 11. So good for you, and good for your son.
And
he,
good for,
that he's
good
reading.
For Tiffany.
Yeah.
For getting her kids reading. It's absolutely essential.
Is there a difference in your mind between the experience of reading a book on a tablet or on your phone, or pretty soon on your watch, as opposed to...
I don't make a judgment. I don't really care how people read. I just that they keep reading. Same with the kids. Now, one of the tricks is that you now have about a third more adults who are reading on tablets, so they don't go into bookstores, which threatens bookstores, which is not good. And that's why Borders went out of business, which is not a good thing. Kids have not made the transition to reading on tablets. Some do, but mostly they don't. So now we have a third of the families, they don't go into bookstores, so they no longer buy books for their kids, and the kids aren't reading it. So that's a problem. And I remember talking to Jeff Bezos about it, and he said he would get on it, but I don't think he really did. I mean, I think Amazon has turned around, and they're doing a much better job than they were in the beginning, when they seemed to be, you know, more interested in pushing themselves and kind of hurting publishers. But they still, I think they could still really do a much better job in terms of getting kids reading.
You have also been very personally generous with philanthropy.
And because I gave you that $5?
No.
You're welcome.
I didn't realize that was for me. That's terrific. Yeah, you're on. I accept. And I got you lunch, too, by the way. But your commitment to libraries, to education programs, to teacher training, to mm-hmm. reading programs is, you know, well documented. So literacy obviously is something that's important. Getting kids and everybody else to be readers and interested in reading is important. But also in this day and age, there's a big concern about media literacy. There's a concern about people being able to discern what is true, what is not, mm-hmm. what is valid, what is not, what is credible, what is not.
Yeah.
Can fiction play a role in that? Can the stories that people
read? Well, I do
read...
nonfiction too, but I mean, I think a lot of it is, it's once again, the parents have got to take some responsibility. When Jack was little, he come home from school. How was school? Good. And I'd say...
Yeah, the one-worders.
No, I'd say, no, dude, that was an essay question. Why did you say good? And all you're trying to do, in a fun way, but you're trying to get them to think beyond the... And, you know, so he would either then say, you know, here's why I said good. Here's why my brain came to that conclusion and lay out the reasons why. Or he might say, well, actually, it wasn't that good. And then he would, you know, and that's what, and I think more and more we need to do that with kids. And the more concrete and simple it is, the more likely you are to teach them how to think. I wish every day in class they would just stimulate kids to think deeper, think it through more. And not with stuff that's relevant to them is the best. What are you going to do after school today? I don't know. Okay, well, let's just work it out. What could you do? You could play some soccer. You could read a book. You could go see your grandmother. What are all the and just get them used to that thing of thinking it through. Think it past the first thought in your brain. I mean, I have a problem with people that go like, oh, first impressions are so important. I mean, a lot of your first impressions stink. People that I thought I wouldn't like and I love them, and people that I thought I would and I don't. And, you know, so we overestimate that whole thing about first impressions. And I think especially now, I mean, we just have to dig deeper. You know, you watch television, you watch the political ads, and I blame the networks to some extent. I mean, you know, don't let this, here's a commercial for tomato juice and you're all over it that is supposed to be accurate. And then, you know, you watch the political ads and you go, is anybody saying, you know, checking the facts, or they can't both be right because they're both claiming that the, you know.
Completely opposite.
I don't know.
And it's tough to discern for voters and for everybody else. Well, Jim Patterson, it's been terrific to meet you. Thank you so much
for
coming
great.
By.
This is great.
I really appreciate it. I hope if you're in town
Let's
again,
do another hour.
I'd be fine with me. All right. By the way, we'll leave you with one comment on Facebook from Chuck, who says, it's a pleasure listening to you today. I've read all of your Alex Cross books. When will the next one be released? Well, we happen to know that the next one will be released in 2 weeks, the latest in your Alex Cross series. It's called Target, and the novel that James Peterson wrote with President Bill Clinton is called The President Is Missing.
And Kid Stew.
There's a marathon of Kid Stew on MPT here in Maryland from 6:30 to 8:30 Saturday morning. Season 2 of that series launches in May. That's it for this Election Day edition of Midday. I'll be back here in Studio A tonight at 8 o'clock for our coverage of Election tonight in Maryland. NPR will have the national results, and I'll be joined by the WYPR news team and a panel of experts for results and analysis of all the big local and statewide races here in Maryland. Tomorrow at noon, we will take a look at some of those races with Jane Miller of WBAL Television and Andy Green of the Baltimore Sun. I want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. They've got location and their hours listed at joesquared.com. We'll see you back here at 8 o'clock. I'm Tom Hall. Go vote and have a great day.